The choices you make with your lifestyle, your money, every single day, influence your future. Become informed. Act with purpose. Build your tomorrow. This podcast is dedicated to sharing ideas that you can use to take ownership of your financial future. Most Americans have little or no net worth. By being purposeful with what we earn, I believe we can change that. Welcome to Money is Personal, the Briggs Financial Podcast. Salutations, greetings, and hello. My name is Stephen Briggs. I am the owner of Briggs Financial, and this is Money is Personal, episode number 7, Tackling the Challenges of Healthcare Expenses. Healthcare is one of the most challenging topics we face as people, as a country, especially in the United States. It's a very contentious issue politically in terms of how our healthcare is managed, how our healthcare is paid for, what those expenses actually are. And so this ends up being because it's not just a monetary topic in terms of just sheer numbers. It's a very personal topic because it hits into, it's literally who you are and how you are taken care of over the course of your life. And so the thing about healthcare expenses is that it carries just a large number of feelings and ramifications from what care you may or may not have access to, depending on what funds you have available and the ethics behind that, to having an unforeseen medical expense hit and the consequences of that. And so wrapped in all of this, we've got to try to break this down in terms of knowing that a number of these things exist and knowing what we can and cannot control. We can advocate for different policies. We can advocate for certain ways our expenses are treated. But at the end of the day, we still have an individual responsibility or an individual opportunity, I guess, to be prepared when it comes to our medical expenses. Now, before we dig into kind of where I'm going to go with this in terms of what vehicles exist in this world financially thinking about medical expenses, it's important to know a few kind of realities when it comes to healthcare. First, that no matter how healthy or sick you are, a turn for the worse, a bad medical situation can happen to anyone at any time. You can be a marathon runner and still get hit by a drunk driver. You can be someone who is chronically ill who slips on the sidewalk and breaks their hip. We can all get cancer. We can all, no matter, heart condition or lungs-wise or that sort of thing, we can, one of the number one causes of death in this country are heart-related conditions. And that can be, now, that said, we can do things in our lifestyle that will make us more inclined or less inclined to have those troubles come up when it comes to a number of the systems in our body. But in the end, mitigating risk factors does not eliminate the risk of healthcare problems outright. You can have a very healthy lifestyle and have bad things happen to your physical health or to your mental health. And so to that end, when we talk about healthcare planning, you look in the mirror and go, well, I'm healthy now. There's no guarantee that you will be healthy in the future. I had a couple of friends last year, beginning of the year, things are fine. 3-4 months into the year, one of the two of them realizes they're not feeling very well and they've been chronically not feeling well, finds out they have cancer. A few months later, they've passed away. And that happened to a couple that, these friends of mine were in their 30s. Not in their 70s, not in their 80s, not in their 90s, 30s. The beginning of the year, everything was fine, at least as far as they knew. And by about this time, they're neck deep in, you know, into one being a widower, the other having passed away, and having to move, you know, cope with that in terms of a lifestyle and living situation. In terms of, thankfully they, you know, in this case they didn't have kids, but if they had had kids, what would the kids have done in that situation? How would you take care of them and their long-term expenses? So this comes part and parcel. Healthcare, it is an incredibly, like I said, it's an incredibly sensitive topic. It's got very large ramifications. And yet we really don't put nearly as much thought into how we are preparing for that for our families. And yet it's one of the biggest risk factors when it comes to a household's wealth and their ability to sustain moving ahead. In fact, medical debt is the single biggest cause for bankruptcy in the United States. Think about that. It's not student loans, it's not mortgages, and it's not even credit cards. As much as I talk about discretionary spending, as much as I can talk about all these things we need, it's still not the biggest risk factor of bankruptcy. Biggest risk factor. Now, granted, it is medical expenses. And granted, those other things make it more difficult to save for your healthcare. To make that a priority when you're spending on junk, when you're overpaying for things like a car loan, when you have, you know, that's all true. But the real kicker is that we don't want to think about the fact that we can get sick. We can suddenly have something very bad happen to us that may affect our entire family. And may cost a small fortune to try to take care of. So with that, let's talk about in this episode, first, I want to start by talking about two of the savings vehicles that often come up this time of year when you look at your employment package. You probably are making elections for what your healthcare is going to be for this next year. And those are the health savings account and the flexible spending account, known as the HSA and the FSA. After we talk about that, I want to dig a little bit more into thinking about broadly about how your investments can play into your healthcare situation, how insurance can play into a healthcare situation, and at least touch on some of the big ideas and concerns surrounding those products and services and those industries and some of the and what some of the hot buttons are that you may want to look into. So let's first start talking about the HSA, the health savings account. HSAs are health savings accounts that are attached essentially or are part of something that you can do when you are enrolled in a high deductible healthcare plan. A high deductible healthcare plan, or an HDHP, is a healthcare plan that typically has lower monthly premiums, but it passes a substantial amount of risk onto the policyholder to maintain good health. One of the things that an HDHP does is, by virtue of having, by virtue of you being eligible to put it contribute to an HSA, is that if you are healthier and typically younger when you are in one of these, but you have the potential eligibility to save money and have that money be sustained long term for help potential healthcare expenses later on. But the thing about an HSA is that it actually has a lot of value in the healthcare space, as well as beyond the healthcare space as well. In spite of its name, a healthcare savings account health savings account does not just have to be a savings account like a bank. There are many HSAs available that go well beyond what a traditional savings account offers, that allow you to invest in stocks, invest in mutual funds. This becomes really important when you think about health savings for this reason. Healthcare expenses have typically gone up 6 to 7% every single year since 1980. And there's no slowing down in terms of what those numbers are looking like. As drug companies charge more, as hospitals and doctors' offices and services charge more, the bottom line is that if you leave your money sitting in a bank and are hoping that nothing else is going to change in terms of the open market, it seems likely that you're going to end up having less purchasing power long term. If but nothing else but via inflation, but certainly if you add what the actual healthcare market is doing, that you're going to be left in the dust when it's time for you to put that savings in. Or when you, unless you're going to immediately spend that money now, in which case that's a different conversation. But if you're looking ahead, if we're looking at this long term and saying, how do I prepare long term for my healthcare? Having it sit in a static account likely is not going to keep up given the historic market of how much these things have increased in cost. So the ability to be invested in funds that have the potential to keep up with those expenses, that's a very important part about having a sustained healthcare savings. Another big benefit is that healthcare savings account contributions are tax deductible. Withdrawals from those accounts are tax-free for qualified medical expenses. This does not include healthcare premiums, so you can't use your HSA to pay for your insurance premium. But a lot of other things, from prescription copays to doctor's visits to medical bills, are covered by this. Most expenses are covered. If you're concerned, do take a look at the IRS or federal government website on it. Additionally, contributions are not restricted to just yourself. If you have family members or friends that want to contribute to your HSA, they can. They won't receive any tax benefit for doing so, but they can still gift that money into that vehicle for you to use for that purpose. Moreover, the growth of the investments in the account, as well as any capital gains and dividends that are earned over time, are also untaxed in an HSA. Similar to an IRA, even bigger, at age 55, just like how in, you know, when you get age 50 in an IRA or a Roth IRA, you can make an additional $1,000 catch-up contribution. At age 55 in an HSA, you can do the same. And at age 65, you can withdraw money from the account for any reason without incurring a tax penalty. So not only is an HSA, like I said, a healthcare savings vehicle, but it actually carries a special duality as another tax-advantaged vehicle for any expenses later in your life. Now that said, there are special restrictions and catches that involve this. You can withdraw the money at age 65 for any reason, but it's going to be treated as ordinary income if you withdraw it for a non-qualified retirement expense or a non-medical qualified retirement expense. So the HSA, if you go and just draw it out during retirement to go play a round of golf, it's going to be treated like income. You really want to hang on to this money to use for health savings so that when medical things come up later on in life, you're not paying taxes on that growth. If you just use it as a piggy bank for yourself, you will be paying taxes on that money even at age 65. Additionally, if you're younger than 65, and you withdraw that money, and there are some qualifying conditions that are exemptions from this. But if you don't qualify for those things, and you're not 65 and you withdraw from this account, and it's not for a medical expense, you are not only going to pay income taxes on the withdrawal, but you may be subject to an additional 20% tax penalty if it's not that qualified medical expense. An additional 20%. Meaning, if you're putting into this account and you're contributing, again, this is not a piggy bank that you just spend on whatever. This actually needs to be for medical things. Now, if you have a chronic condition, if there are things you are regularly paying for in your life, already this is going to be a major benefit for you. Because instead of spending that money after being taxed on it, you could be contributing to your health savings account, withdrawing the money from that to pay for these expenses, and not pay taxes on those expenses because they came out of the HSA. Think about what you pay in taxes and add that percentage back in. And that already adds a level of affordability off the bat. The final thing I want to bring up regarding just the HSA account itself is that it can have some hidden and expensive fees embedded in the client agreement. That could be for usage of a debit card if it's attached to it. Some of them have monthly or annual fees to the custodian just to have the account. So you need to be aware of what these costs are before you decide, oh yeah, I'm just going to open up an HSA. My employer has one. You don't have to go through your employer to take advantage of an HSA. And even if you don't have an immediate payroll deduction, if you contribute to an HSA outside your employer, you can deduct that from your taxes when you report the following year. Any contribution into an HSA, whether it's made by your payroll or made by you personally and then later deducted, counts. So keep in mind that you have those are options available for you. But to also know that when you have those costs, especially early on, that can be a heavy drain on your HSA. And especially over a long period of time. So these costs need to be minimized. And you need to make sure to look for those sort of things. Healthcare savings accounts have some very strong potential benefits. But with these restrictions and the penalties I've talked about, before you go starting to make contributions, some things to think about. If you have a high interest credit card debt, you're sitting on something that's squirting out 22, 24, 27%. As much as I want to tell you, hey, contribute to this HSA, that thing bleeding off 22% a year is likely, that could be your tax rate for all I know. And if you think about that balancing, the kick is you may or may not have medical expenses, but you definitely are paying interest on those credit cards. Paying down that high interest debt and having a good emergency fund, those are important things that do need to be in place when you're thinking about an HSA, because not having those things in place may make the HSA just not an effective tool for you. And of course, in all of this, I'll remind you that this is a great time to sit down with your financial planner. If you don't have one and you want to consult with someone, I know a guy. But the bottom line is that you should probably, at that point, making sure you've got all those facts and that information to make sure that contributing to an HSA is actually a really good fit. Cannot stress enough seeking the advice of qualified tax professionals and financial advisors to review your individual situation with you. That's important. Do keep that in mind. With that, I want to shift gears to the next type of account that often comes up this time of year. And that's a flexible spending account. A flexible spending account, which is an FSA, is a special account that you put money into to pay for out-of-pocket healthcare costs. Just like an HSA, you don't pay taxes on the money. You'll save an amount equal to the taxes you would have paid on the money you set aside. Employers may contribute to an FSA. They don't have to. FSAs have limits to what you can contribute. They're limited to $2,650 per year per employer. If you're married, your spouse can put up to $2,650 in an FSA with their employer too. You can use your funds in FSAs to pay for certain medical and dental expenses for you, your spouse if you're married, and your dependents. You can use the FSA funds to pay deductibles and co-payments. Can't use it for insurance premiums. You can use FSAs on prescription meds, over-the-counter meds. You know, same basic list that you're going to see with an HSA. Here are the catches with FSAs. FSAs typically do not let you carry the savings from 1 year to the next. HSAs, when you put in that money, you can put it into a vehicle. It can grow long term and build for you for later on down the road. An FSA doesn't let you do that. An FSA may carry a couple of special provisions if your employer has elected for them. One, it can provide a grace period of up to 2.5 months to use the money in the FSA. It can allow you to carry over up to $500 per year to use in the following year. Your employer can only offer one of those options, but they can't offer both. And they're not required to offer either one. So FSAs are tricky in that you have to know what the terms are before you contribute. And you also have to think about what your expenses are going to be for the year, because any money that isn't used is lost. So you don't want to have that money lost from your FSA. You don't want to put more money in than you think you'll spend with a year on things like co-payments, co-insurance, drugs, and other allowed healthcare costs. FSAs are far more common, you know, in terms of, well, frankly, they're the only vehicle that you can potentially use if you are not on a high deductible healthcare plan. And are, you know, like I said, in terms of the restrictions, they are, it's even more stringent and it's much shorter term in terms of a vehicle. So while they sound the same, HSA and FSA, they function very differently in terms of what they actually can do for you. And to make sure you understand how to use this, HSAs can be used both short and long term. FSAs are very much about contributing for that year for what you anticipate will be that year's expenses. Now, that said, if you're looking at it and going, well, I know what my regular insulin medication is, or I know what my allergy shots are, you have an idea what those expenses are, and you can contribute in that, and you get the tax advantaging from it. That's a good thing. If that year you know you're going to max out on things because maybe your wife is pregnant and you're looking at a variety of maternity costs, then you may look at that and go, I can easily drain and max that thing out. And you can change it on an annual basis. So if you know this year, hey, we're bringing a new child into the family and we're going to be spending that money, but next year we're not. By the way, when you have kids, those medical expenses kind of go up, period. But you then maybe look at that and go, okay. Or maybe you have a surgery coming up. Maybe you're going to have a knee replacement or a hip replacement. And you know that's a one-time sort of thing, hopefully. You sit there and go, I hope I don't need to have the same knee replaced twice. But the bottom line is that you could save for that. And that's a pretty good thing. So HSAs, FSAs sound similar, have some overlapping benefits, have also some very different implications in terms of timetable. With having talked now about these different types of accounts, I want to shift gears toward long-term healthcare planning. And I want to frame it by starting to talk about longevity. Science has been amazing the last 20, 30 years with better information in terms of our health, better ways of early detection of various illnesses and diseases, with how we can increase our monitoring, with the improvement of medications. We are living longer and longer and longer typically on an annual basis in general. At this point, if you're age 65 right now, statistically, it is almost a coin flip that if you and your partner are 65 now, that one of you makes age 90. More than likely, if there's a female in that partnership, the female would make it there. Women are you know, just simply have a longer life expectancy from men by several years. To that end, we really need to be thinking about not only your healthcare while you're living, but also, if you are married, thinking about what your partner's assets will be or what they'll have access to should you or them pass away. What does that financial picture look like? So when the question comes up of why am I, you know, as worried about investing in my 60s or 70s or even if I'm in my 30s and going, why am I thinking about this thing that's going to, you know, maybe may or may not happen 40 or 50 years from now? The answer is because these costs are going up rapidly. We don't have a crystal ball to know what the future will look like regarding long-term costs. And with us living longer and longer, it's entirely possible that the current 30-somethings, by the time they reach age 65, could be looking at triple digits. Could be looking at triple digits on average. Our Social Security system, our retirement system, is not equipped to handle that. Not even close. Not built to handle basically 35 more years of life. And the expenses that go with that. Expenses in terms of not just drugs, not just in terms of surgeries, but thinking about care in terms of housing, clothes, food, potential hospitalization costs, custodial care, getting help with eating, dressing, walking, bathing, other daily activities at home. There'll be a lot more people, especially if we look at the next even 15, 20 years. There's a reason why the medical devices industry is skyrocketing. We're starting to see the very first of the boomer generation hitting, you know, starting to go into assisted living and nursing facilities. This is only going to continue to grow for quite a while. And as it does, and when it does, the question simply becomes, do you have the money to pay for it? Are you prepared? The idea that there's a misnomer that Medicare will pay for this stuff. And that's not what Medicare does. Medicare does not pay for long-term nursing or home care. It'll pay for short stays in a skilled nursing rehab center, but it's not going to pay for those long-term care expenses. You know, this is kind of a personal one for me. I mean, my grandmother, my mom's mom, for a number of years needed a lot of assistance. And my mom spent an inordinate amount of time going back and forth from our house to my grandmother's to do things like laundry and clean the apartment and make sure that there were groceries in the fridge and that. And without anyone else really to help or, you know, not, I mean, there was a, you know, a very inexpensive part-time person that would come in once in a while. But as time went on, my grandmother needed more and more intensive care. And there was no resource to pay for that. So what happens when that happens, by the way, because I got to walk through it and see it in my life, is once a person's assets are completely depleted, and I don't just mean kind of sort of depleted, I mean entirely nuked, then that person will qualify for Medicaid, at which point they then can enter a long-term facility funded by a combination of Medicare and Medicaid. And the kick is that, I'll say it, Medicaid homes scare the hell out of me. My grandma, you know, lived if I'm not mistaken, my memory check, about 5 years in a Medicaid home before she passed away here about a year ago. And the thing is, those homes are not, I wouldn't even just say not glamorous. My grandma had a 7x10 room with cinder block walls. There was a window. There were places to hang. She could hang things sticky tacked to the walls, but this is, yeah, and she may or may not share a room at any given point. She's in a facility where people are dying all the time with other people that are as old, if not older, than her. She got 3 square meals a day. They did their best with some social activities. I'm not knocking the home. They're working with what they've got in terms of funding. And the nursing was fine. They were nice people. They tried their best. But I think about that as a family member going, I don't want that for my parents. And I sure as heck don't want that for myself. But the thing is, when you don't have money to pay for these things, that is what you end up with. So as you're thinking about this, if you're, you know, in your 60s thinking about this, that's not that far down the road. If you're in your 30s thinking about this, you also need to take the mindset that's not as far down the road as you think it is. And the thing about it is, especially if you are younger, is that you have an asset that I cannot buy for you. You have a resource that no one can acquire for you, and that's time. When we think about investments compounding and growing over a period of time, that time thing is not something I can acquire for anybody. And if you have it on your side, then you have a strong advantage that you can and should and need to use and need to think about so that you can actually prepare for these things that happen later on. Because as I'm looking at where Americans are at in terms of their savings, 1, less than 30% of them age 60 or older have even 6 figures worth of savings, which 6 figures by in itself likely doesn't make it all the way through retirement either by any stretch, unless there's some major pension or other supplement that goes on through the rest of their lives. 6 figures in the bank doesn't mean anything at age 65, not anymore. That's just simply not going to be enough money. And yet 70% of Americans who reach age 65 will likely need some time of long-term care, according to federal estimates. So only 22-23% have any amount of actual resource, and yet 7 out of 10 are going to need long-term care. That is a lot of burden that is going to go onto the Medicaid system. And the bottom line is, if your choices are, hope that Medicaid will take real good care of you, or, you know, I need to save money up, and we need to make sure we have some defenses in place to protect our family, who would you prefer to rely on, if you have to make the choice? Because I hate to say it, you're gonna have to make the choice. And this gets even more compounded if you have kids. Because you not making the choice makes their life even more difficult in terms of what they're going to have to do. Because ultimately, unless you hand it off to a third party, they're likely the executors on whatever will, power of attorney, etc. to carry out your wishes moving ahead. And they're going to have to watch you go through this. This is why you need to take ownership of this stuff. And even if you're sitting there in your 20s and 30s, why you need to be thinking about this stuff. Because you know what? Your parents are eventually going to be going through this, if they're not already. And you will need to be going through this. And you either have these things taken care of, or you don't. And there are some very natural consequences. And I got to see all of those. And they were terrifying. Now, I count my blessings and lucky stars. My parents had, you know, their retirement is taken care of. They have done a great job of saving. They're well prepared. I am not worried about them. They're very prudent with their resources. But most aren't. you've got to think about this stuff when you're thinking, boy, do I need to pound another, quarter pounder meal at McDonald's? You go, well, what does that matter regarding this? It is all those nickels and dimes. Do I need that new iPhone? Or can I handle a refurbished one or a used one? You know what? If the cost difference is going to be $500 over 2 years, think about that $500 and that compounding over the course of, is that 20 years? Is that 30 years? Is that 40 years? Is that 50 years? Could you 40 or 50 years from now take that $500 and compound it 7 or 8 times? Do you need that money then? Probably. A couple of other topics along this line. One of the ways that policymakers had hoped this would be taken care of is a product known as long-term care insurance. Long-term care insurance was supposed to be designed for people, for middle-class, lower-class individuals, to pay a premium so that when they got older and they needed these longer-term care expenses to be paid, that they would do that would be taken care of. And that was actually the government's hope, was that private solution could help mitigate some of these costs. Here's the problem. Those insurance companies, by and large, when they opened and started working, did not anticipate just what those expenses would actually be, or that we would live as long as we did, and are, and continue to. They did not anticipate that the profit taking they were taking from those things would result in them bankrupting themselves, which many of them have. And or, as a result, asking lawmakers, asking people to be able to jack up the rates, the premiums, on existing policyholders, let alone new policyholders for those products. On top of that, there are all sorts of nasty little conditions you can find in many of those long-term care policies, including caps, dollar amount caps, on how much service you will be provided before the policy will just shut off. Now, I've not surveyed the entire field of all the long-term care products in the history of ever, but generally speaking, these are the risks that exist and have hurt many, many, many people. I'm not going to pretend to be a fan, and I'll leave it at that point. If you are looking at one of these, you really need to do the math on it and really look at the terms. I will say on the flip side, especially if you have kids, that considering things like a term policy as you are building wealth, to make sure that even if you or a loved one is incapacitated or killed for whatever reason, that you have assets available to make sure that the kid's education is taken care of, that your home mortgage is paid for, that maybe living expenses for a period of time exist. And if your employer offers life insurance, that you really could, take a hard look at terms of the costs. As I've said in a previous episode, I am finding more and more employers offering market rates that are far below what I've seen on the private market. That's not to say that there couldn't possibly be a product or service that beats that one way or the other. But I'm saying, as far as a trend is concerned, if that is an option and a resource for you and it financially makes sense, and this, again, consulting a financial advisor to assist you on this one, that's a good thing for you. But you need to be aware that these long-term costs exist and that the solutions that people try to portend, well, this is why you buy insurance. Well, not all insurance is created equal, not by a long shot. Many insurance products, quite frankly, while they may be able to sell it to you and get away with it, are not something that I would be recommending for you to buy. And again, having an expert in your corner and talking through these things and actually crunching the math out, it'll be pretty evidential whether or not that product or service or plan works. And if it sounds like it works too well to be true for what you're paying, then likely there is something more going on, and it's It should, if anything, it should not just ring in your head, oh my gosh, I found the perfect plan, it's such a great deal. It's, how are they trying to bait me to buy this product or service? To think defensively in that situation. Because what's happening is, when people are getting sick, and they are relying on these long-term products, and they don't do what they said they were going to do, or they did what they said what they were going to do, and that was misrepresented in some form. Or just simply, I thought this product did one thing, but it did something totally different instead. Because the client misunderstood what that was. They found themselves with big bills, no way to pay for them, putting them in a position where at that point, you have people with pre-existing, you know, with conditions, with, you know, maladies that are having to try to jam away at work instead of getting better in their 60s and 70s and 80s all the while. And instead of it being the golden years of their life, they're suffering. Because what they thought would happen for them and thought that what they had been paying for just hasn't happened. And again, if you're going to rely on the government on this one to just handle it or come up with a solution, I think it's lazy. I think that type of thinking is lazy. I think it's a bit disingenuous. And I think you're not going to like what that conclusion looks like at the end. I hope that we can fix a number of these things over the course of my lifetime. But if I had to sit there and say, well, I'm going to wager my life on that, nah, no thanks. That said, it's not easy to save for healthcare. It's not easy to pay for healthcare. Healthcare is expensive. I don't, unfortunately, have the solution to that one. That's not my seat in life at this point. But what I can say is, we can be intelligent about what vehicles we use to save for our healthcare future, that taking advantage of things like HSAs and FSAs as vehicles for savings, long-term and short-term, can save your household money, and that when you think about why investing and asset allocation, even later on in life, is important, think about, again, that fact that since 1980, we have consistently seen a 6% annual rise in healthcare costs. And that's where making sure your complete financial plan, from eliminating that credit card debt all the way on up to investing and building wealth, really comes to a head when it comes time to start having to pay for these expenses, and you either having the resources to take care of you and your loved ones and your family, or not. On that note, that is where we're going to end this episode. Thank you so much for listening to Money is Personal. Please share this with your family and friends. Please consider writing a review on iTunes about the program. And thanks for listening. Have a wonderful week, and we'll catch you next time with a fresh episode. Take care.